Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. If this is your first time streaming or downloading the program, Guelph Politicast is an interview show where I talk to politicians, activists, and people of note making a difference or are just trying to make life in the Royal City more interesting. For previous episodes of the Guelph Politicast, you can find them on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or you can subscribe through iTunes or Stitcher. Today I talked to sexual assault counselor Hannah Graves and public educator Jessica St. Peter of Guelph Wellington Women in Crisis. Issues of sexual violence and gender equality have been all over the news lately, from the trial of Gian Gomeshi to the comments of U.S. President Donald Trump. But between the headlines, there's the difficult and emotional work of helping women deal with rape, domestic abuse, and getting the people that can do something about it to believe them. Women in Crisis is the topic of this week's Guelph Politicast. Now, May is Sexual Assault Awareness Month in the province of Ontario. According to the Government of Ontario website, this month is a time to raise awareness about the devastating impact of sexual assault and focus on the measures being taken to stop violence and support survivors. It is estimated that about 1 in 3 Canadian women will experience sexual assault in their lifetimes. In fact, statistics indicate that 39% of women report having experienced at least one incident of sexual assault since the age of 16. And if that's not chilling enough, a Globe and Mail investigation said that 1 out of every 5 reports of rape that are filed with police forces across Canada are labeled as unfounded. So there's still an uphill climb for those helping women to get justice. Turning to Guelph specifically, Guelph Wellington Women in Crisis marks its 40th anniversary this year. On the one hand, it's an incredible legacy, but on the other hand, it's a legacy that those that work there wish they didn't have to be a part of. Women in Crisis has grown over the last 4 decades to offer a more broader, comprehensive set of services to meet the individual needs of any and all women that need their help. What began as a crisis helpline out of the university now includes the Marianne's Place Shelter, the Transitional and Housing Support Program, the Family Court Support Program, the Rural Women's Support Program, the Sexual Assault Center, and of course, the 24-hour crisis line. So to mark the 2 occasions, Sexual Assault Awareness Month and the 40th anniversary of Women in Crisis, I invited staff members on the show to talk about how far we've come on awareness, treatment, and justice for sexual assault survivors, how we still struggle with trying to educate people about the meaning of consent, and all the other challenges informing and educating the public on these very important and sensitive issues. Unfortunately, we can't say that we're getting any closer to not needing a Women in Crisis anymore on its 40th birthday, but I think we can all agree that what it does is needed now as much as ever. So I caught up with Hannah Graves and Jessica St. Peter earlier this week in studio.
Hi, I'm Jessica St. Peter. I'm the public educator with Guelph Wellington Women in Crisis.
And hi, I'm Hannah Graves. I'm a sexual assault counselor with Guelph Wellington Women in Crisis.
And thank you so much for being here today. It's the 40th anniversary of Women in Crisis in Guelph. I don't know if congratulations is the right term to throw out there for being around for 40 years, but and I know that the two of you have not been around for involved in it for all the 40 years, but in terms of from what you know, in terms of the history of Women in Crisis and your own work today, what do you think has changed in terms of the work that the Crisis Center does today as it did when it first opened 40 years ago?
Yeah, so when Women in Crisis started, it started here on campus. And it was a response to just female students who were seeing it and looking at, you know, what do we do? And so they started by doing a crisis line, but then realized that a majority of the folks that were searching out services for domestic violence. So it started with kind of a sexual violence rape crisis center feel, and then was looking at, okay, now how do we support people who are experiencing domestic violence? And so you see the funding in terms of looking at space and housing and creating a shelter. But I think one of the things that stands out for me, so I've been with the agency for going on 8 years or 7, it all blurs together, but it's just, you know, when we're tracking back the HER story of Women in Crisis, you can see the significant impact that the community has had in terms of recognizing, oh, this actually takes place, and, you know, it's not just, in other places or, you know, othering people, but that these are our neighbors, these are our own lives that need the support. And so looking at just the reputation that the organization has gained over the years in terms of collaboration has had a significant impact, because it looks at, you know, we have the Sexual Assault and Domestic Violence Action Committee on Sexual Assault and Domestic Violence. So aligning all those community supports so that there is consistency. So whether I disclose on campus or I disclose at another agency in the city, I know that I'm going to get a similar kind of response and that people are aware of the services.
Mm-hmm.
So that collaboration piece has made significant impact in terms of not only how we run our organization, but in terms of how people access support.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. I think that the services that we offer to have drastically, I don't want to say drastically changed, but there's a lot more. So even we have a family court support program now, which 40 years ago would not have been in place. So there's just a lot of different avenues that we know women leaving violent situations need access in so many different areas. So we can offer services and programs to meet those needs, mm-hmm. which is really fantastic.
And I think even the importance of the community holding an organization like ours accountable to that change. So, you know, the emphasis on intersectional approaches and that we can't say we're a feminist organization without taking those intersections into play in how we offer services, but also how we do the inner workings of our organization.
Would you say that's almost made the work more complicated, though? Because on the one hand, you could argue that the having this organization helps, and things have gotten better for women in terms of having some place they can go, some place they can interact with. But on the other hand, the center itself is sort of splintered off into all these sort of, I don't want to call them niche needs, because it's really not niche in terms of how we typically understand that word, but you have far more services to address far many different problems.
Mm-hmm. I think that the work has always been that complicated,
mm-hmm.
to be entirely honest. It's that now we have a better understanding of it. We're more aware of, so the needs of a woman who's a newcomer to Canada and who's in a domestic violence situation is going to be different than someone who's always been local. And so we are more able to look at those needs and understand them and meet them. They've always been there. It's always been complicated, but... And I wouldn't say that we're splintered, because I think that all of our programs work really collaboratively.
Right.
Like, we work really well together, but acknowledging that my area, my specialty of area, is not domestic family law. And so if I have a woman who's coming to see me, she can also see somebody else to meet that need, but we're working collaboratively together.
Mm-hmm. Well, areas of law is something that we did want to talk about, because there's been in the news a lot lately this quite horrid statistic that one in five reports have been ended up prosecuted or have been addressed by the police. Did that surprise you, the two of you, having worked in this field, that the police were not holding up their end?
And just to clarify, that's not even prosecuted.
Right.
That's one in five are marked unfounded. So they're
okay.
Said that unfounded is basically that this was not a crime. It didn't exist.
Right.
Yeah. And I think just in seeing the response from sexual assault centers across Ontario is that none of the people doing advocacy and supporting survivors are shocked by this.
Right.
It's something that we've been saying for years, whether it's within our own circles or in terms of advocacy for survivors on a greater spectrum. And I think finally now there's something out there that we can use to say, like, this is the reality, right? So instead of, you know, arguing all the time that folks aren't supported, it's now, this is proof that they're not supported. Now what do we do,
right?
And maybe this is what it takes to realize, you know, when we look at the Sexual Violence Action Plan or we look at different legislation that's being put into place, putting more money into the justice system isn't going to solve this, right? We got to look at why are there such low rates and how do we support people who choose not to go through that process for various reasons, because that's what we've been, you know, people in the movement have been saying for so long.
Yeah.
So it's not just a concern about money. It's a concern, or in terms of investment in the justice system or the investment of time on the part of investigators and prosecutors. There are things, what I hear you're saying is there are things on your end that also need to be worked on in terms of getting justice for victims?
Well, I think in terms of on our end, I would say the justice system and powers that be or have influence, giving a greater voice to organizations that have been supporting survivors for years, and seeing them as the experts mm-hmm. in that area. And so when we look at, you know, conversations around the Philadelphia model and things like that, having sexual assault centers be part of that conversation. So when you're reviewing cases, because those people that are working with survivors are well aware of the myths that are perpetuated, mm-hmm. How women's stories are taken and twisted so that they're re-victimized through the process. And that's what's being said over and over. So it's not, you know, on our end, we constantly have to continue to improve the services, but it's looking at what's being said and what's been said by sexual assault centers for years right. is being proved, right? So it's just stop silencing those sexual assault centers and say they're radicals and, you know, they're not looking at the whole picture. When we look at the stats, it's being reflected that the services are not meeting the needs of the people who need them.
Yeah.
Yeah, Charlie Angus said something that struck me when he was in town a couple of weeks ago when he said, you know, you don't, when you go to a fraud trial, you don't, the person, the prosecution or the defense don't ask the fraud victim, are you sure you were ripped off? Which is, you know, it's such a simple comparison, but it really blew my mind. It's like, yeah, we don't ask people who, you know, had their bike stolen. Are you sure your bike was stolen?
We don't interrogate victims
yeah.
in
exactly.
any other crime. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a really pervasive myth that sexual assaults, that a lot of people fake it.
Right.
And that a lot of people are, I guess, misreporting. And it's really pervasive and it's a problem. And we know that statistically, that's no greater than in any other crime. And so it's a problem. Yeah. And I mean, consent is portrayed as this really difficult thing to know when you've given consent or not given consent, but you know, and women know, and so it shouldn't be something that's constantly called into question. Did you actually consent to this or not?
Right. That's a great segue for something I was wondering. Why is the concept of consent so hard, apparently, for people to wrap their head around? It seems like so simple a thing. And there's some wonderful posts on your Facebook page about, you know, what consent is. And in terms of, you know, there was the thing this morning, FRIES. I can't remember what the FRIES stands
yeah.
for.
Yeah, yep. It's freely given. I posted that too. yeah, it's Planned Parenthood actually came up with that acronym to help remember it. Freely given, consent is reversible, so you can...
Right.
You can give consent and then say, actually, this isn't working. We need to stop at any time. I don't remember the other ones now.
We won't get hooked.
We, yeah,
won't,
we won't
get hung
get,
up
won't get
on it.
It, but
it,
but it you
does,
can go
it
look
does
it
speak
on
to
Facebook.
The. It does speak to the. We have to consent, which you think would be simple enough. We have to even simplify it further. The
yeah.
idea of consent.
Yeah, and yeah, it's. Because human nature is really complicated, right? And our interactions are complicated, we tend to look into it almost more than we should. And we also aren't good at teaching it. So it's not taught well in schools. Are you looking at body language? Are you asking those things? I know when I was growing up, it was always no means no.
Right.
But then what do you do with a maybe? What do you do with a yes, but? All of those things that are not taught and hopefully are with the kind of sort of recent changes to sex ed curriculum. Hopefully that's changing and we're talking more about looking at consent and what consensual behaviors across the board, not just in terms of sexual activity, are and look like.
Well, you're right. It was something that I think was missing with when I took sex ed in school. It seems that it was hung up on the mechanism of sex more than the social aspects of it. It was just purely
Absolutely.
About, you know, what peg goes in what slot,
mm-hmm.
et cetera. It does seem like that whole, I almost made another bad pun, but it almost seems like that is a aspect of our education that has been lacking.
Yeah, and the social aspect of sex is huge.
Yeah. The court systems, are you finding that the court is catching up now? that it's you know, we had the Gomeshi case, which of course very infamous and also shows how the system fails as well. So are we learning from these examples, or are they just kind of proving the point that the court is kind of failing victims and that more needs to be done? And in the meantime, the failure continues, even though we recognize the failure.
Yeah. Like, the court system is predominantly designed for stranger rape or sexual assault where people have no prior relationship that can be used against them, right? That idea of what we're told all the time, watch the white van, don't go down dark alleys.
Right.
But that's not the reality of the sexual violence that we're seeing in the community. And I would say that through those larger social media cases and you're seeing that people are being held accountable for what they say, mm-hmm. right? So no longer are judges and lawyers, you know, allowed to say whatever they want, but that they're being challenged.
Right.
And I think that those challenges are important because it leads to education. So I think now more emphasis is placed on making sure Crowns know about, you know, trauma and that they're trauma-informed and making sure that lawyers are aware of not only services that are in the community to refer out to, you know, the idea that you don't have to be an expert in all areas, but that you do owe some kind of support for that person. So I would say that we are learning, and I think every time that, unfortunately, every time that something bad happens or those terrible cases take place, people lose out, but at the same time, we take those opportunities as learning moments.
Right.
It's just, unfortunately, there has to be several dozen before we actually take action. And that's what we're seeing is that in terms of my role, specifically around public education and that violence prevention piece, it's always reactionary.
Right.
So we come in and we want to do these educational, we want to do this preventative work, but it's not until something hits the fan or, you know, parents are up in roars that, okay, we'll call you in and now we want to talk about sexual violence and, you know, unhealthy relationships. And we're seeing that the same in terms of legislation and court. It's that people have been victimized before we actually do anything.
And it does almost seem like it's almost on the shoulders of people like yourself, the public educators. That's who's sort of instigating that change. It's the outside pressure. It's the public pressure. And it's not necessarily coming from the system itself.
No.
And I mean, we're learning, but the learning is slow. I mean, this has been something, we've been here for 40 years, right? It's something that we've known for a long time. And we're talking about huge systems, so it's not as simple as changing the way that we do things on the ground. It's yeah, as you said, it's massive systems that don't necessarily have the same pressure to change unless it comes from larger, almost like larger legislative bodies.
And that division that you talked about earlier with our services, it's not as if our organization chooses to divide services that
way.
It's looking at funding, right? Everything comes down to what are you funded to do, right? So we have a sexual assault center that's funded for sexual violence. We have a transitional housing support program that's funded to do domestic violence. When we look at the province as a whole, sexual violence is where public education comes from.
Right?
So we're not funded to do preventative work around domestic violence and family violence. We're funded to do preventative work around sexual violence. And that makes no sense.
Right?
It should be, we want violence, gender-based violence to end. We need to support it from all angles. And that prevention piece is key. Instead of just looking at how are we going to continue to dole out money to support these people who've been victimized instead of how do we stop the victimization before it happens.
I think that's something, I didn't mean to cut you off, but
okay.
It's something that I think I just wanted to point out that people think that government just sort of gives out checks to organizations. That often these come from grants that are tied to very specific things. So you may be able to get as much money for you want to do one aspect of your services, but the other aspects like the prevention, you're facing the struggles of raising that money. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I wanted to hear what you had to say.
That's okay. Well, and I think it's important to point out too that we don't get all the money that we want.
Right.
unfortunately, we could probably use a lot more funding than we have to do the work that we do because it is ongoing and many, many people come through our doors. But just to tie in that there's also this idea that sexual violence and domestic violence are very separated, and they're not. We know that a lot of the majority of sexual violence is actually by people that you know, either family members or partners, stuff like that. So there's this idea that it's all separated, but it's very enmeshed.
Mm-hmm. Right. What do you think the biggest? I mean, we've talked a lot about the educational aspect, and but in terms of your challenges right now, what specifically are you dealing with other than trying to raise awareness about consent and the various different needs, the law enforcement aspect? Are there any other challenges? I mean, I'm sure there are more than a few.
Yeah, it would be easier to ask what isn't challenging.
What isn't a challenge?
I think that no matter how you look at it, whether, you know, Hannah speaks from the direct interaction with survivors or whether we look at community responses, is that there always needs to be more.
Right.
Right. And it's not just about money. It's looking at collaboration and things that are going on. So it's hard to say specifically what would be large challenges. You know, we're in a business where our hope is that we're out of business, right? Like we work ourselves out of a job. So it's like when people ask, where do you see the agency going in 10 years? You know, my hope is that it doesn't exist, but the reality is the way things are going is that we're going to need to expand and not expand because we want sexual violence and domestic violence to continue to happen, but we need to respond to the realities of what that looks like. And, you know, you kind of were talking about different services or niche kind of markets or things like that, but that's what it's going to continue to need to do is grow, because right now, you know, we've seen it over time is that there isn't one solution that's going to help each of the folks that comes in. It's going to look very different depending on where they're coming from. And so sometimes you have to specialize those programs so that people feel comfortable to come forth and have those conversations, because even in terms of outreach, looks very different when you're talking with new immigrants as opposed to when you're talking with students on campus, when you're looking at workplaces or working with professionals in terms of how do you create a climate, you know, where consent is part of that on all levels.
It almost speaks to your success in raising awareness that you further specialize in different areas and different needs as they become available.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, and that people are able to, yeah, have all those marginalities met almost.
Right. I did want to address another specific thing, and it was an article that was posted on your Facebook page about how men don't understand sexual assault as well as women, and I found that interesting. And the article goes into details about how things like voyeurism, you know, there's not an understanding that that is also a type of assault. So in terms of that understanding, something like revenge porn, which is a problem, you know, people posting what were supposed to be private videos between partners online as, you know, revenge for breakups or what have you. Is there more understanding now? I mean, not just in terms of the general community, but I mean in men specifically. Are you seeing that awareness in terms of what constitutes assault? Is that having an effect?
I don't work with men. I would be totally honest with that. I pretty exclusively right now work with women, so maybe I'll let you address that.
It looks different. Like I've seen even in the time that I've been here, the change, but. Because we're always, so somewhat, our organization supports self-identified women.
Right.
But at the same time, when we work towards ending gender-based violence, all folks benefit, right? It's not as if we would just turn people away. We would do referrals depending on what services they would need. But that understanding, it's not as if we can say men are to blame for that,
right.
For that lack of understanding. It's look at how, you know, I get called in to do girls groups, young women groups all the time. No one says, hey, we have a group of guys who really want to know about healthy relationships or, right, they just are dismissed in terms of, well, we'll emphasize the importance of women protecting themselves and we'll hope men just kind of go with it.
Yeah.
But I would say what I've seen is that there are a lot of, you know, male champions in our community that we don't give enough credit to or we don't put in the spotlight to emphasize, you know what, they're doing great things. You know, they respect women. They, you know, are mentors in our community in terms of how they encourage other young men to act. So I think that drawing attention to that is important and that changes it, because we don't want those men that are out there that want to participate and want to be allies.
Right.
They need an avenue to do that. And I would say that's somewhere that our organization needs to grow, is we can't look around and go, there are no men who want to support. At the same time, we don't have very many avenues for men to get engaged.
Right.
So I would say that's probably the number one thing I hear in the community is, where's Men in Crisis? Like, you're here representing Women in Crisis.
Right, where's Men in Crisis, yeah.
Right? And it's like, as an organization, the more support for survivors, the better, but don't expect it to be our job to do that, right? Yeah. Like, we can advocate and we can support, but those male champions need to step up and do that work so that those services are reflective of the population that they're going to serve, right? And there are some sexual assault centers that support both male, female, all folks. You know, it just depends on where the funding was allocated based on what kind of relationship do they have in the community, and are they the best location to provide that service. And our organization, because of its reputation and emphasis on women, would not be the best organization to do that.
Right.
And I think that the way that we're talking about consent, we've seen a shift to, instead of just are you giving consent, to are you asking for it, and that onus is often placed on men, which it shouldn't only be. It needs to be both partners, but that conversation in terms of how consent is asked for and received is changing to be more inclusive and to have it be, you know, this is on both parties.
And the more we talk about, you know, empowering women in terms of enthusiastic consent to be able to, you know what, this is what you're down for, this is what you like, why can't you have that conversation instead of always being put in this respondent role, like I have to wait until someone tells me or asks me what they want for me to say something, right? That conversation needs to shift both ways so that it's not, we're not setting up young men to always put them in this place where they have to chase and pursue,
right,
which often leads to pushing too far or not knowing where that boundary is. And then young women who, you know what, I'm into something and I want to try something out, but I don't live in a world where it endorses that, because then I'll be slut-shamed and millions of other things will happen.
Yeah.
And this also isn't something that you learn on your own. Yeah. And so if we don't have the role models and we don't have people teaching it, then it's hard to develop, because as a young person, you don't automatically learn that.
There's so much to unpack there, because, you know, it's the way men are traditionally, you know, viewed or taught to view themselves, the way women are traditionally taught to view themselves and view other women. The idea of slut shaming: if you like sex, you're a slut. Mm-hmm. If you're a man and you like sex, you're just a regular old man, not old man, but regular guy. And that the goal seems to be sort of really truly equalize the sexes in this regard, that it's okay to be a woman and like sex, it's okay to be a man. And let the woman pursue you. And I am curious about, we kind of talked around it, but obviously I am a man.
Mm-hmm.
I identify as a man. Look at how I dress, but that's neither here nor there. I do wonder, in terms of what you guys, as working in this field, expect from potential allies who are men, in terms of raising awareness, in terms of supporting the center. Do you have any expectations? Do you try to do that outreach to try and find those role models you were talking about, Jessica, to not have the onus, because that's what you're basically talking about. The onus is all on women, it seems, to raise this awareness, to talk about consent. The onus, it has not yet really been asked to be put on men in terms of their educational needs, that for them to seek out what consent means to what a healthy sexual relationship looks like.
I think that there's a lot to address there, because I think that men can do a lot in allies, even in just being a bystander, right? So we know that in terms of addressing sexual violence, bystanders can do a lot in terms of, even, hey, I see that my friend is really, really drunk and is about to go off with someone. Right. Am I stopping and saying, hey, you should probably come home instead? You might not be capable of consenting. And so men can do a lot in that bystander role of even in stuff like, hey, why'd you catcall that person? That's not cool. Because we know that sexual violence is not just sexual assault. It ranges all the way down to gestures, comments, looks, that type of harassment that is really normalized in our culture. It's an everyday thing. And so I think men can do a lot to kind of hold each other accountable and to say, like, this isn't cool, this isn't okay. There's a lot, yeah, just on the ground level, without necessarily needing to be that I'm gonna go hold protests or I'm gonna make an educational thing or get grants. You can do a lot on the ground level, or you can also do bigger stuff.
Just in your everyday life.
Yeah.
And we, you know, we have a volunteer training program that we would encourage all folks to participate in, regardless mm-hmm. of how they identify. And it might not be even, you know, I choose to stay and volunteer with Women in Crisis, but looking at what do I learn just through taking that, you know, and that idea of what does it mean to really be an ally. And, you know, we have people who will help with specific events who reach out and say, this is something that's important. Me and a group of friends want to help out. And we'll always take people up on that offer. But it's just in terms of that consistency, because when it comes to advocating that we have more opportunities for male allies, right now I don't have the male allies to advocate for.
Right.
Right. So if people were sending me emails and blowing up my phone texting saying, you know what, I am a male from this community and I really want to make a difference, then I'd be able to go higher in our organization and say, you know what, there's this group of men that want to do something. How do we put something in place to support them?
Yeah.
Right. But right now it's usually a one-off. It's someone who says, you know, I want to help for a specific event. It's someone who, you know, maybe responding to community outpour of terms of things they might have done in the past and looking at, I don't want to be perceived by this way. How do I get more informed so that I don't have this reaction or I don't make this impact on someone else in the future, right? So there are various levels that people can participate. It's just looking at if this is something that you're really important in, having that ability to stick to it
mm-hmm.
and realize that you can't just knock on a door and say, you know, I want to be an ally,
right.
But you have to prove it,
yeah.
Right? And you have to make a commitment. And, you know, the number of times where I'm like Facebook searching somebody going, you really want to participate, but if you looked at the groups that your friends are part of, you might see that, you know, that's not reflective of what you're trying to tell me that is important to you, right? And
right.
So from things that you like on Facebook and, you know, things that you share, you know, are you standing up and being that bystander? Are you perpetuating gender-based violence, right? And so having those conversations and holding your friends accountable, right? Your friends and family, and having those conversations that, you know, initially you're probably not going to be people aren't going to be a fan of you, and they're, right. you know, you're going to be that shitster or person that has that reputation, but someone needs to have those conversations in order to get it going. And an ally is not just something you deem yourself, right?
Right.
A community has to endorse you. And
yeah.
I want more male champions in our community to step forward and prove that that's what's important to them.
And being willing to do your own work in terms of, like, and honestly, in terms of, we, like, you have, there are so many pervasive myths around, like, masculinity and what it means to be a man,
right.
and what it means to be a man sexually. And so being willing to look at those things and do your own work around unlearning some of them. And yeah, just because that is hard to do and it takes effort, and not only expecting people to teach it to you,
right.
being willing to do the research yourself.
Yeah. And I think that's sort of key, is your idea of, you know, at the, it kind of falls into the idea of slackerism, and, you know, I just, oh yeah, I know, I'm a total ally, and now I'm gonna go post, you know, some M&M YouTube video or something. And yeah, it's I do like that idea that if you want to count yourself an ally, you have to go out and sort of do your research and know what you're talking about, and not just say it. Unfortunately, we are running out of time, but other than needing more male allies to do the good work and to dig in themselves and find out more about how they can be better men, let's say. What kind of assistance are you looking for right now? How can people get engaged and get involved?
So May is Sexual Assault Awareness Month. So right now we're doing a social media campaign looking at consent and how it plays in our everyday life. So encouraging people to be part of that conversation. And, you know, even if you read something and you're like, I don't get it, or it doesn't make sense, but to challenge that, and that's part of the conversation, is that sometimes we have to question things, you know, change our perspective, take a look at a different angle. So encouraging people to be part of that, but also emphasizing that, you know, we have a 24-hour crisis line, and that it's, you may not be someone who's a victim or a survivor, but you may be supporting someone, and you're like, oh, damn, I can't remember what Hannah and Jessica said in terms of how do I support somebody, so I can call that, right? I can call that crisis line and say, you know, I have this really dear friend or a family member that's going through this, and I want to know what's a safe way to support them.
Absolutely.
Because I don't know what to say off the top of my head, but I don't want to say anything that's going to re-victimize them or silence them so that they don't reach out to somebody in the future.
Mm-hmm.
So just to be aware that if someone is in crisis or needs to call, that we have that 24-hour crisis line. So it's toll-free at 1-800-265-7233 or local at 519-836-5710.
That's such a great point that you don't have to be in crisis yourself, that you can reach out and learn how to help someone in crisis if you know someone in crisis. So I think that's I think that's good to keep in mind. So Jessica St. Peter and Hannah Graves, thanks for joining me today. I do join you in hoping that you will one day be out of a job.
Thank you.
And I think a lot of people do, but thanks for coming in and talking about the issues today.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
And once again, that was Hannah Graves and Jessica St. Peter of Guelph Wellington Women in Crisis. To learn more about Women in Crisis or maybe get involved, you can go to their website at gwwomenincrisis.org or call them at 519-836-1110. If you have experienced or are experiencing physical, sexual, emotional, or financial abuse and or stalking, you can avail yourself of Women in Crisis services 24 hours a day by calling 519-836-5710 or toll free at 1-800-265-7233. And that's it for this week's edition of the Guelph Politicast. The music for the Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics, and Sid Dale, the host for the Guelph Politicast, is Podbean. Go to guelphpoliticast.podbean.com to listen to past episodes, and while you're there, you can also listen to Open Sources Guelph. If you missed last Thursday's episode on CFRU, you can download it via the Politicast channel on Podbean. You can get in touch with me by email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com. Reach me through Twitter at adamadonaldson. You can go to the Guelph Politico Facebook page at facebook.com/politicoguelph. And of course, you can donate to the Guelph Politico Patreon at patreon.com/guelphpolitico. If you like locally sourced independent media in the city of Guelph, please consider donating. For all the latest local political news, check out guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca, where we will have a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you shortly. And until then, see you next time.